This is Andre Traversa with Paula Thompson beside me here. And we are excited today because we are having a return guest on the show. Before I introduce our guest, though, I'd like to comment on something that I thought was kind of funny. And I thought it was something that our listeners might find amusing. I'm sure, Paula, you're familiar with the hysteria that was started over the Harry Potter books when they came out. A lot of conservative Christians thought the books were from the devil because they promoted witchcraft and all this other stuff. Well, it's very interesting because I guess the poor J.K. Rowling, the author of Harry Potter, gets it from both sides, because now Richard Dawkins, who is an atheist, is now saying that Harry Potter books are probably bad for kids because they teach anti-scientific, irrational beliefs to children, and it's not a good idea for kids to be fed fairy tales and stories about magic, because they'll just start believing in other fairy tales like the existence of God and things like that. I thought it was kind of funny, you know, that that sometimes people get it from both sides. But you know, Paula, I got to tell you, and this is worthy of a topic for another show. But I don't know about you, but I think, and this is something our listeners may want to reflect on, I think fantasy literature is really good for kids, because you know why? It gets them to start thinking about a world beyond this world. And I think, and besides the fact that it's good for their imagination, I think it starts getting them to think about things like that, which I think is great. So, anyway, today on The Cosmic Citizen, we are going to be interviewing Mark Siljander. Again, Mark Siljander was with us last week, but we didn't get a lot of time to really talk to him individually. So we're going to do that today. Now, Mark Siljander is a former congressman from Michigan. He has written a book called A Deadly Misunderstanding, One Congressman's Quest to Bridge the Muslim-Christian Divide. Mark Siljander, welcome back to The Cosmic Citizen.
Andre, Paul, great to be back with you. Thanks again for having us back again.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for coming.
Mark, I guess the first, you know, your book is so rich. I've read most of it. I haven't finished all of it, but I read most of it. And it's so full of details and anecdotes. It's hard to know where to begin, but I'm going to just ask you this question. That is, I guess, what led you on this personal journey to even do this? I mean, why? It's probably one of those situations where you probably never thought that God was going to lead you on this journey to bridge the Muslim-Christian divide, did you? I mean, it was kind of something, it wasn't like something you intended to start doing at some point, did you? Was it?
No, it wasn't, actually, Andre. I was a conservative evangelical Christian. I probably would have been the first one to talk about the Harry Potter book. And you just tried in the beginning. But the paradigm crash began when the Quran was read at the National Presidential Prayer Breakfast, back maybe 16 years ago, by the Saudi Arabian ambassador to the United States. So I fired off a letter, angry letter, saying, how can the book of the devil be read at this Christian event? So that one of the people that's been backing it for probably 50 years came to my office on the Hill and said, now, so have you ever read the Quran? I said, well, no. He said, well, how do you know it's of the devil? I said, well, because that's what I've been told. You know, we all bask in ignorance, right? So then the second question, he said, well, what's your strategy then for Muslims if you think, you know, the Quran's of the devil? What would you recommend for them? And I responded, well, we need to convert them to Christian religion. And he said, well, where do you get that strategy from? And I laughed at him. I said, well, the Bible, of course. And when he said, when he challenged the basis for that of like a quote or two from the Bible, I was embarrassed, frankly humiliated. I couldn't think of a single verse at that moment. So I told him I'd get back to him and bashfully exited the room and studied the New Testament for a year, reading it three times to vindicate myself, Andre and Paul. And guess what happened?
You couldn't.
Exactly. I couldn't find a single verse that Jesus never mentioned the word religion. From the point of being institutional, not once. I thought, well, wait a minute. If he never mentioned religion, why is my emphasis, you know, claiming to be a follower of his, so much in the context of religion? Secondly, he never talked about being a Christian or Christianity. I'm not against these things. I'm just telling you that he never mentioned them, which was a shock to me personally. So that's when the paradigm began shifting. So I thought, well, if I've been told all these things in the past by these so-called religious leaders, which I was not, as a political person, what else have I been told that maybe isn't consistent with the teachings of Jesus that I can see reflected in the Bible? So I began this journey looking at the Eastern understanding of the Bible. Remember, the Bible was originally, I believe, written in the Aramaic language of Jesus. However, it was the theologians in Christianity claim it came from Greek first. So actually, the Bible really is a composite of Western thinking, but it's abducting an Eastern movement of Jesus, Eastern teachings, metaphors, and idioms, and transferring it to a Western mindset. I think a lot of it has been lost.
Interesting. Let me ask you, one of the things I want to just come back to a minute here, you say this over and over in your book, you say that what's really important is to introduce people to Jesus, not to Christianity. And one of the things that happened is when you started talking to people of different religions about Jesus, you guys all ended up being unified. You didn't fight over doctrines and theology. Nobody said, oh, you're preaching Christianity. No, instead of talking about Christianity, you talked about Jesus.
You know, I mean, that's exactly the point. I found everywhere we go, including, you might have saw the story when I was with His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. It was quite a privilege to spend time with him way up in the mountains in northern India. And we talked Jesus for over an hour. But we did not talk religion or Christianity from the institutional mindset. We just talked about the teachings of Jesus. He got so excited that I don't think it was because of our meeting, but because of the ideas of Jesus. You know, the Dalai Lama wrote a book about Jesus.
Wow.
And it's a really great book. Most Christians read it and say, oh, he must be a Christian. Well, you don't have to be a Christian. You can be a Christian and follow Jesus, but you can follow Jesus and don't have to be a Christian because, again, I want to reinforce, I'm not against Christianity or being a Christian. That's my culture and background all my life. But there's no mandate in the Bible, whether it's Greek or the Aramaic, that you have to be a Christian or join a religion of any kind called Christianity or anything else to be a follower of Jesus. So that's a huge paradigm crash for the Western Christian world, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It is a huge paradigm crash, but, you know, I think there's something to replace that. And, of course, the Arantxa book says this, and the reason I believe it is because it makes so much sense. There is the religion of Jesus as opposed to the religion about him. And what Jesus really brought us was a universal religion, a religion of peace, love, understanding, tolerance, forgiveness, mercy, you know. And Jesus took the time to get to know people, and I think what stood out in your book for me, and I loved your book, by the way, and I highly recommend it to our listeners. It's wonderfully written. It's Mark's story. It's engaging, you know, hard to put down. And I think what the epiphany you had for me that stood out was when you were as an ambassador at the UN, you started talking to people. You went to them and you said, you know, this is boring. I was touched by that. That tickled me because, you know, You're a courageous person, and you went and said, this is boring. I want to talk to these people. I want to get to know them. And the great epiphany that happened when they all said to you, gosh, Mark, you're the first one that ever asked me this question. You're the first one that ever bothered to engage with me at all and ask me anything more deep than how's the weather. And you said you would have thought that was an isolated incident, except it happened over and over and over. Every single person that you interviewed from the UN, from other countries, said the same thing to you. You really care what I think about this kind of thing? And you realized, which I think is a basic tenet of peace, that you engage them in a conversation where you cared what they think, what they know. You got to know them, and all of a sudden you started to relate to them. And I think the only way we'll ever take our place in the world, I mean, what our show is about, being cosmic citizens, not just in the world, it keeps expanding, this citizenship. We're not just Americans. America can't afford to feel that way anymore. We have to become a global community. And we have to draw the world together with understanding. Obviously, if we don't, you know, even the title of your book, A Deadly Misunderstanding, it is deadly. If we allow these divisions to continue on without taking the time to get to know one another and understand each other and create bonds of friendship just by showing that we care, that is what Jesus did. That Jesus came here and got to know us. He was certainly an ambassador from the heavenly realms. And he came here, and he got to know us. He took the time with us. Why? Because he loves us. Because he cares. He didn't judge us. We judge each other. So I think that is such an important distinction that even Buddhism, Hinduism, they're all religions about something. Confucianism, they're all about a person or a philosophy. But the true religion is a religion that unifies us at a core level, which is the religion of the spirit. We have something in common. We have a creator in common. We will never all think alike. So do you think that's true? I mean, to me, that was your great epiphany when you got to know these people. Would you say that's
Hello?
True?
Yes, Paula. You've brought up so many good points. I don't hardly know how to answer so many thoughtful points that you made. But let's start with the last one first. The reason I wrote A Deadly Misunderstanding is because I wanted at least to share my journey with other people, and they could draw from it what they wish. And we attempted to write it to both the Western and Eastern world, or you could say the Christian and Muslim world both. And as you probably know, that was a challenge because most books are written to either their own group or they're written to the other group telling them how wrong they are. So what I'm trying to do is to say to both sides, sort of the Christian, East and West, you know, maybe we ought to reevaluate ourselves first, where we're coming from, our own holy books. Then we can take a fresh look at each other, and perhaps we can find through these linguistic discoveries that we present in the Deadly Misunderstanding, we can find more common ground together. Now, the epiphany, too, is directly to your question or your comments, fine comments, Paula, is that the epiphany to me is that what is religion exactly? I mean, we can all have our definitions. We can look it up in the encyclopedia and the dictionary. But really, I sat with the head of the Sharia Council of Sudan, nonetheless. And the Sharia Council in Islam is the head of the legal council. He's one of the top scholars and professors of Islam in a given country. So we had dinner several times together. And I asked him, I said, you know, the Quran says that the true religion with God or Allah is Islam. The true religion with God is Islam, and the Muslim radicals take that to say if you're not in our Muslim or Islam club, you know, our religion club, you're therefore an infidel, and hence, in their militant view, worthy of death. And this is a critical question. He told me that the Arabic for religion in the Quranic verse is deen, like spell like the D-E-E-N, deen. And I said, what does deen mean exactly? Now, Paul, this is going to be a real exciting thing, I think, for you and your listeners. He said it's not a membership in a club, like the Islam club or Christian club or whatever. He said it's the state of your personal being, of your internal faith, where you are. And if you're Islam, which means submitted to Allah or the one God, he said that's really what that verse means. So now get this one. So I said to him, well, wait a minute. So let me retranslate the Arabic in better English, and you tell me if this is correct. Again, I'm talking to the head of the Sharia Council of Sudan. So the true state of one's personal being or faith is submission to the one God. He said, yes, that's the perfect way of translating it. So I told him, well, what if I, from a Christian background, consider myself submitted to the one God? What does that put my religion from your point of view? And he said, well, you'd be a spiritual Muslim. I said, all right, so what we're enjoying then is the common ground centered around what you might have alluded to, Paula, is there a religion or faith? If it's not a club membership, but rather a state of our mentality, a state of our faith, a state of our submission, a state of our point of view, if that's the case, then we can be part of the Western club and enjoy the common tradition or commonalities of this common ground of faith and hope, and especially around the teachings of Jesus that you well articulated, I think both you and Andre well outlined the teaching of Jesus of peace and reconciliation and mercy and faith and goodness and servanthood rather than self-centeredness. So if you take this conversation with this sheikh, this head of the Sharia Council, and if we could expand that to 50 Muslim countries and 50 Western countries and come together with an edict or fatwa, as they call them, that anyone who believes in this way is part of the commonality of faith, even though we retain our own traditions and cultures and our own aspects of a reflection of our faith, this would be a powerful challenge to the militancy in all faiths.
So are you saying basically that that what the Islam really means, or religion really means in Arabic, is that essentially, I mean, it's about submission or being submitted to God. But basically, are you saying essentially that at the core of all these three religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, that your relationship with God is more important than all these specific doctrines that you believe?
Yeah, I think that's, in the end result, the doctrines of men. In fact, Jesus warned and Paul warned, don't get hung up in the doctrines of men and women, the doctrines that people assemble, but they're really the doctrine of God, I believe, you know, from my reading of all the holy books, the Torah, the New Testament, as well as the Quran. And I, and by the way, 30 years ago, I read the Urantia book. I haven't read it in 30 years, but I did read it 30 years ago. what I can draw from all of that is really the doctrine should be of what the submission of love, unconditional love of our heart, mind, soul, and strength of God, and the loving of one another. If we start there, that may not be the end result, but what a powerful way to start a relationship.
Well, and you know what? Here's the thing, Mark. And I have kind of a question for you. It's kind of an unrelated but related question, I guess. And that is, this may get into translation issues too. And I know you've been very interested in translation issues with Aramaic and that kind of thing. But I have to tell you, I have a hard time with the word submission or surrender in particular, because I've heard people say that Islam also means surrender as opposed to submission. Because when I think of surrender, I think of what armies do when they throw up their hands and surrender to their enemies. One of the things the Urantia book tells us, and one of the things that really closed the deal for me on the Urantia book, was it says in one place, it says that when we give our hearts or we give ourselves to God, it's not a surrender of will. It's an affirmation of will. It's a glorification of will. And they say that you don't even have to say, it's not my will but yours be done. You can say, it is my will that your will be done. The book is very strong on free will. It says that God doesn't coerce anybody. So do you think the words submission and surrender, do you think that they do you think that maybe some of my discomfort with those words, maybe the way they're translated into English? Because, I mean, do you think that Islam, for example, Islam is not hostile to free will. I mean, it's not saying that our submission to God should be involuntary, is it?
That's an excellent question, and it really is, because I don't think the scripture, when it talks about surrender, because remember, the word surrender in the original language is the same word for shalom in the Hebrew, which is peace.
Okay.
So it doesn't really mean submit or surrender, like bow down or give up anything. And I think we talked about this in the last show, but the word convert in the King James Version, or convert, comes from an Aramaic root that means the same word as shalom, which is peace. And why does it mean that? How can you get surrender out of peace? Because when you'd go on these narrow pathways, you know, in trading routes, you'd come across someone coming the opposite direction. And what you'd do, you'd open your hand in an open posture to the passerby, which is called a salute, like we salute in the military, or a handshake, to show that there was a peaceful intent and that they had no weapon and the person could pass by in peace. So it's a personal decision of opening the hand in submission, in peace, that you have a peaceful intent. So you're right, Andre. It's up to us to have the will or the desire to open our hands to God and say, in a sense of peace, we choose to submit ourselves to the power and inspiration and to the wisdom of the Spirit, rather than being forced to do it.
It seems to me like, for a good long while, maybe for the entire history of the planet, I don't know, but it's and this is my time, so I'm more in tune with it, obviously. But and this is obviously the last 100 years have been remarkable in the sense of change. But it seems like more and more this battle of ideologies has become intense, and even more intense, and divisive, and even more divisive, And so you had said, and I think everybody, when you talk to the Western world, being from the Western world, you said you went to the bombing when they bombed, what was it, in Beirut? Or when they bombed the barracks?
The Marine barracks in Beirut.
Yeah, and you said it was just such a shock, a stunner that, you know, you went through that and the soldiers were all so demoralized, and, you know, just the way you described it, I really felt the impact of that event. And now we've got 9/11, and that has impacted all of us. You know, you were impacted more by the Beirut thing. It wasn't as visceral to most of us, but then 9/11 is like, oh, now we're all there. We all see the dangers of these radical, dangerous ideologies. And you know, I've even been worried that at some point the United States could break into another civil war over the same thing, these dangerous ideologies. And you had said in your book that there were three things that most Muslims would really contend with us on, three points of contention that were bordering on blasphemy for them. Would you reiterate those three points? And then I'd really love to hear what you think we can do to help these radical ideologies subside a little bit so that peace and reason return to, you know, do you hold out much hope for some of these barbaric notions that people hold?
Well, I always hold out hope, Paula, and the three specific things, at least in the context of Islam now, focusing narrowing down to there, where they would view a Christian ideology or a theology as heretical. The first one, that God would beget a son named Jesus or anyone else. So beget Jesus being the begotten son is number one. Number two is that Jesus is God or deity. And three, in this notion, Christian notion of the Trinity, these three areas are just considered an abomination and really cause the fuel of the militants to recruit well-meant, young, impressionable men and women of Islam to hate the Christians, to hate the West, thinking we're all decadent and we believe these horrible things, that Allah would come in the form of a human and there's three gods rather than one, and somehow Jesus was one of those gods. So if we could, and I've asked many Muslims, if we could bridge those three huge concerns and come to as much agreement between the two of us as Christians do amongst themselves, what implications would that have? And every Muslim president, scholar, or cab driver I've spoken with, they all say the same thing. It changed the whole world. And I said, are you telling me just those three simple items? And they say, no, Siljander, they're not simple. These have been a deadly, deadly misunderstanding for 1,400 years. It caused wars, killing, hatred, recruiting a militant, suicide bombing. It gives them their religious foundation for their bitterness and hatred. And if you undermine the religious foundation for the hatred and bitterness, what do the militants have left, Paula?
Now you're talking about getting at the root cause.
Exactly.
Okay, but let me ask you something, Mark. What is? I'd like you to go through each of these points. And by the way, before I do that, I want to make sure we give our phone number out, 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158. And I want to make sure I point out that one of our listeners, Diane, called me this morning and asked me to ask you a question, Mark, but I was in such a rush that I didn't quite get the question. So, Diane, if you I'd be more than happy to have you call in, so please do, and you can get your question. I think it actually has to do with what we're talking about, but let me ask you this. I think I was just at the part of your book where you started talking about these three things. That's where I stopped. So let's go with these three things one at a time. The first one was the idea that Jesus was the begotten Son of God, and that's considered blasphemy to Muslims. Now, you were trying, I think in your book, you found a solution to these three problems, right, or that you thought that there was a way to bridge this gap?
Yes, that's right, Andre. In fact, it's not a theological basis. It's simply linguistic. So either the linguistics are either correct or they're not. So we presented, by the way, just as a preface, these findings to the Vatican in Rome, Oxford, Edinburgh, physically there, as well as the scholars at Harvard, Yale, and a dozen Muslim universities, Wheaton College, many Christian universities. And they've all unanimously, Muslim and Christian, unanimously, from the right-wing evangelical schools to the Vatican in Rome, the scholars have said these are correct. You know, these linguistic misunderstandings, they confirmed that yours truly has sort of inadvertently tripped over. I'm no scholar, Andre and Paul. I've just sort of tripped over these things and found this bar of gold, like taking a walk in the woods and tripping over something and I grabbed this bar of gold and ran all over the world. Is this really pure gold? And they're saying, wow, where did you find this? And
okay, let's take it one at a time. Let's go with the begotten. Let's go with begotten first.
So the begotten Son of God, is Jesus the begotten Son of God? The Quran says 11 times that it says, Isa al-Messiah, Jesus Messiah, la walid ibn Allah, is not the Son of God. 11 times. It's without equivocation. It's clear. There's no debate. Another 12 times it says that Allah or God has not taken his son or taken a wife. So what does this mean? Christians get very offended. They think Muslims are infidels because it says 11 times that God does not beget his son, and the Bible says repeatedly Jesus was the begotten son. So how do you build a bridge over a seemingly antithetical notion? Well, here's what it is. It's so simple, you're going to actually... I had one person almost faint. It was so simple. He couldn't believe it. And one of them, I think, was a Muslim who had killed someone over this issue. But anyway, here it is. The word walad in Arabic and the Quran meaning begotten is a male-stemmed word that simply means conceived from him. In other words, physically, sexually. So if the correct translation in English should be, God has not sexually conceived a son named Jesus. Because Jesus was not sexually conceived. The Quran says Jesus was supernaturally conceived by the Spirit of God through a virgin named Mary. Now, Christians say, wait a minute, that's what we believe. I go, exactly. That's why the book's called A Deadly Misunderstanding, because the Quran in English has been so twisted, and since 92% of Muslims can't read the Arabic of the Quran and understand it, very few, of course, Christians can. As a consequence, most people just accept the translated versions, which they just simply... God has not begotten a son named Jesus. But they say, well, what does your holy book say in the Aramaic? Well, I tell the Muslims, the Aramaic, for example, in the Gospel of Matthew, is very simple and very short. The Gospel of Matthew gives the lineage of Jesus. And it says, Abraham begot Isaac, who begot Jacob. And that word begot, by the way, is the exact same word walid as the Arabic of the Quran, meaning caused to be born sexually. But when it gets to Jesus, in Matthew 1:16, verse 16, the word changes from a male-stemmed word in Aramaic to a female-stemmed word in Aramaic, etlad, that means essentially birth from her, implying, number one, there is no him, no man, sexually, and number two, suggesting that everyone was begotten one way except for Jesus, who was begotten differently, and that's purely consistent with the Quran. When Muslims hear this, that the Aramaic version uses a different word for begotten in Aramaic, they jump up, hug you, and get so excited to say, because they finally believe that there's a way to bridge this horrific divide that's lasted for 1,400 years.
Okay, now, and Paul, I want to make sure you jump in here, but before we get on to the next point, I want to point out something to you, Mark, and something you may not realize, and you know, I'm not, you know, this show is a show about the Urantia book, and we believe the Urantia book is a revelation, okay? The book tells us, the book actually rejects the whole concept of the virgin birth. It says that Jesus was born just like everybody else. But see, here's the thing. I think there still may be a way to bridge this gap, because even though the Urantia book rejects the virgin birth, it doesn't say that God sexually conceived, you know, that God somehow sexually conceived Jesus. It just says that Jesus was fully human and fully divine. Because he was fully human, he was born just like every other, you know. It's just interesting. It kind of throws a little monkey wrench into this whole thing, you know, for us as the Urantia book readers, because we believe in interfaith dialogue and we believe in interfaith, you know. I guess maybe a better question to ask would be this. Let's say that you're talking to, let's say a Muslim is talking to a liberal Christian, because there are some liberal Christians who reject the virgin birth. Do you think there's still a way to bridge that gap, even if you don't believe in the virgin birth?
Well, it's going to be very difficult. And again, the book is if you see the subtitle, the Congress's quest to bridge the Muslim-Christian divide, not necessarily the Muslim rancher or the Muslim secular or what have you.
Right, right.
But the main wars have not been fought over people like you, to be honest. It's been fought over people more from the Christian community, like the Crusades and Inquisition.
Right, right.
And the Muslim, you know, Ottoman conquest and the killing now is one of the fundamental reasons is what they perceive Christians believe. So even if you don't agree with either of them, you should be thankful we found a
That's
way.
That's true.
To
I agree with you. You're right. You're
two
right.
People that are going to kill each other,
yeah,
and could end up killing you, you know, with a nuclear weapon, biological and chemical. All these things affect everyone. So I've had my Jewish friends who are atheists, I don't care about anything about the holy book. I don't believe there's even a God. But if you can get the Muslims and Christians not to kill each other and probably end up killing me and my kids, great. Keep going for it.
Well,
you're
right. You got a point.
I absolutely agree with that. But I have to interject a woman's point of view here.
Okay.
This thing about virgins, it's just so interesting to me. No human being gets here except some woman loses her virginity. So what is this stigma? To me, it's almost like, you know, this sense of the unclean. I mean, this is still perpetuated against young women all over the world. I hosted an Indian, and he's actually a Brahmin. He's a priest in India, which is the highest caste. And he said his daughter, who is 13, is just stunned that when she is on her menstrual cycle, she has to go and sit in another room, and she cannot be associated with by anybody in the family. This still goes on in the 21st century. This is a deeper problem. It's not about God. I really have to say, this idea that we have to have a virgin that's untainted, untouched, pure, clean, this is some kind of a backlash against women. And I don't imagine we can solve any of that on this show. It's just interesting that this is such a crux, that whether or not Mary was a virgin and whether or not she had sex with God, you know, it's just an interesting dilemma to me that this notion, and the Urantia book actually backs this up. One of the reasons I love it is because the Urantia book elevates women to equal status with men and says things like, you know, as we in the universe look at this issue, we don't even consider an evolving planet out of barbarism until one sex ceases to tyrannize over another. And what we've had for centuries on end is men tyrannizing over women. And certainly we've come a long way in the Western world. But, you know, and I mentioned this in our last show, it's the same thing. It's the same issue. But here it is. It comes up as this crux, this central issue, whether or not Mary was a virgin, whether or not God had sex with Mary, all of this. And it's all about this act of creation that humans do to bring other humans into the world, which is a good and beautiful thing. It doesn't have to be a dirty.
You know, Paul, you're absolutely right. It is a beautiful thing. And just understand that my personal quest is not to promote even a new faith of any kind, but rather to say we have two groups of people which constitute a huge percentage of the population of the world that,
yeah,
that have held anonymity toward each other and are in the brink of having an Armageddon against each other over ridiculous issues, even if
like
we
this.
Could build the, like this one. But let me tell you just this Aramaic discovery which may encourage you. First of all, Jesus was a feminist, in my opinion. He's
yes,
the first
he was.
Person that had the gall to dare in the Eastern ancient world to put women on par with men.
Absolutely.
He did that repeat, not once, not twice, but repeatedly. He did that to the chagrin of many of the religious leaders and even those who followed him. Number two, Mary, and Martha were an intimate central core around Jesus. There were three women. That was unheard of, totally unheard of.
Yes.
And lastly, who were the only people to stick with Jesus when he was arrested and according to the scriptures, he was crucified? The men all ran away. Even Peter ran away. They all left him, but the women, the three women, his core, which is unheard of to begin with, were faithful. Moreover, from a linguistic point of view, Paula, the spirit in the Hebrew and Semitic language, ruach, is feminine, not masculine. So when we say God is a he, God is, I don't think there is a he or a she in God, personally, but God is the spirit is a she in the wisdom. Wisdom, the word in the Semitic language, hakim, is also feminine. So the critical attributes of God, if you will, the spirit and wisdom, is feminine.
Well, and we believe, as your answer book readers, we actually believe that Jesus has a partner, a sense, a spiritual bride, if you will, called the Mother Spirit. And some of the stuff that is in the Bible about wisdom could be a reference to her. That's also in Greek is Sophia. So I do understand. I do know some of those things that you're talking about. Let's go back. Let's go to the second issue, which is Jesus Christ being God. That's a really strong one for me, because it's interesting because even though the Urantia book says Jesus is not the second person in the Trinity, but it says he is God. So how do we get around the deity issue? The deity.
Okay. Yeah, this is a tough issue, I hope I'm not trying to offend anyone. Only trying to be a bridge builder. And remember, in politics, sometimes you might be right-wing or left-wing, but you have to come, like Barack Obama, wherever he is ideologically, he's going to have to come in the middle and make things happen. But anyway, having said that, the question we ask both, let's say there's a Muslim and a Christian scholar sitting in front of us, the three of us right now, and one said, well, Jesus is not deity or God, and the other says he's all God and all man. So I asked the Christian in front of the Muslim, which part of God, of Jesus do you think was God? And he goes, what do you mean? I said, well, you believe Jesus died, correct? And he says, yes. You believe Jesus was crucified? And he says, yes. Well, I didn't know you could kill God. He goes, what? Well, just what I said. If God is eternal, how does one crucify God? Well, he said, well, that was his flesh. I said, okay, fair enough. So you're saying that the flesh of Jesus, that's why I'm going to Christian, I'm having this conversation now hypothetically with a Christian theologian. So you're saying then that the flesh of Jesus perhaps is a contribution of Mary's DNA, and it was flesh, albeit you argue was sinless or purified as the Quran does in Surah 14:14, but nonetheless, you're arguing that Jesus' flesh was flesh and it died. And they go, I guess we have to concede to that. I said, so what was deified about Jesus? He said, well, it must have been his spirit. I said, okay. So the Christians believe that Jesus then therefore had a deified spirit, at least was the spirit of God. And the Jesus in the Quran, are you ready for this, Andre?
Okay.
He is called Ruhullah, Ruh, spirit of God. So the Muslims totally believe and have to accept, have no option, that there, at least that the spirit of God is a deified attribute of God. And that was essentially what Jesus was. He wasn't a spirit of God, according to the Quran. He was the spirit of God, which is really significant. So there is a deified attribute of Jesus, and that was the spirit, which was God's spirit. And the Muslims say, okay, we agree with that for the most part. And the Christian theologians reluctantly say, well, I guess that's true, too. I said, so what are we arguing over then?
Okay, the thing is, though, that, Mark, here's my question to you, though.
Okay.
Joe, correct me if I'm wrong. My understanding, and again, this is just, I certainly haven't done all the research you have. My understanding, though, was that, and even in a lot of your parts of your book, you say that the Quran refers to Jesus as a prophet. And I think that's where there's all these arguments between Christians and Muslims. The Christians say, we don't believe he was a prophet. We believe he was God. So what is the Quran really? So are you saying that the Quran refers to Jesus as a prophet and as also the Spirit of God? I mean, is that essentially what it says? Or?
No, really, Andre, that's an astute question. Obviously, you've been thinking about these matters. First of all, the Quran says that Jesus is a prophet. So does the Bible. He is a prophet. Secondly, he calls him an apostle of God. So does the Bible. Jesus called him the epistles, the apostle of God. The Quran also says he's a Messiah 11 times. Well, obviously, the Gospels call him the Messiah too, don't they? He's the word of truth. That's a huge thing. Kalam al-Huk, which is Arabic for the word of truth. He's the word of truth in the Gospels. And it says he's the word of God. Woo! The word of God? I mean, that is powerful. I thought only the Bible and the Quran were the word. The Quran says, no, that Jesus came down from heaven, was kalamutuwa, which means in Arabic, the word of God. Well, obviously, First John, the first chapter, says the word became flesh. So I said, well, so where are we disagreeing? The nature of Jesus is clearly outlined, at least in the Quran and the Gospels, identically. In the Aramaic, it has the same exact word. Like, for example, he's Isa al-Masih, that's Jesus, the Messiah in Arabic. In Aramaic, it's Ishu Mashika. It's Allah in the Arabic, and Allah in Aramaic. I mean, his entire nature and all how he's described in the Quran and the Gospels in their Semitic languages are essentially not similar, but identical.
I'm still not quite totally getting it, but I'm going to have to read more of your book, and our listeners really should pick up your book. It's available on Amazon.com, right?
Yeah, deadlymisunderstanding.com, and you can go to that website. It'll take you to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, should be at your bookstores. It's should be all over.
And I want to make sure that they know how to. I want to make sure they know how to spell your last name. It's Mark Siljander. S I L J A N D E R. That's S like Sam, I L J A N D like David, E R. And the book is called A Deadly Misunderstanding. It's published by HarperCollins. Okay, let's go to the last point, which is the Trinity.
Well, you
now
know,
we,
but I'd like to make a point before
sure,
you move on.
Sure,
right.
Sure.
A couple of things. Somebody on the board asked you to spell that word, Mark, that you said, Roe, I can't remember. I can't pronounce it now. But
you mean the Spirit of God?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's Ruhullah, R-O-U-H, Ruh, and that's how you would spell it in English. And Allah, A-L-L-A-H, Allah, Ruhullah. And in Aramaic is Ruka, R-U-K-A-H, Aloha, A-L-L-A-H, Aloha, A-L-L-A-H-A. So it's, you can see, if you write them out, Rukala, Ruhala, they sound, it's just a dialect. Arabic and Aramaic are like dialects of each other. That's why when you compare the Gospels in the Aramaic with the Arabic of the Quran, you get so many remarkable similarities. And believe it or not, Paula and Andre, no one, to our knowledge, including the Vatican, the top scholars there in Edinburgh, Oxford, can find anyone who's done a comparable analysis of the Aramaic of the Gospels with the Arabic of the Quran in a way to try to bring some of these issues we thought we disagreed with together. They've done studies, oh, there's Aramaic words in the Quran, like the word Quran itself is Aramaic, meaning recitation. The word jihad is Aramaic. And there are a lot of hundreds of words in the Quran that are Aramaic. But that doesn't necessarily build a bridge. That doesn't necessarily mitigate the militant ideology of terror that threatens America and the Western world. So we're on a quest to build a bridge that will have some meaning and some end results, if you will, some substantive end results.
Okay. Paula, do you have another question?
No, I just wanted to say I totally get what Mark is saying. Essentially, at the core, we're saying the same thing. And this is in my experience, because I've been to three parliaments of the world's religions now, and I have had a lot of involvement in interfaith activities, and I've spoken to people of all faiths. And what I understand from my experience in that and my dialogues with people of different faiths is at the core we're all the same. At the core we really hold these same beliefs. We just express them in a different way. And something my dear friend Anne, who's listening now, she's actually the one who asked you to spell that word, Mark. She told me something that was a great insight for me. She said, and it was just a little technique for when you have a disagreement with somebody. She said, you know, as you're talking with your husband, if you're sitting across the table from each other and you're having a disagreement about something and you're describing the same object, and I've noticed this in marriage and I've noticed this in relationship. You're describing the same thing, but you're arguing about it. You're really agreeing, but you're arguing about it. And she said, just try this little trick. Get up, physically get up, and go over and sit next to the person you're arguing with. And now look at the object. She said, because you see, when you're sitting across from each other, even though you're describing the same object, and she held up her shoe, I'll never forget this, she took off her shoe and held it up, and we were standing across from each other, and she said, you see, you're looking at a different side. So the way you describe it is completely different because you're seeing something completely different, some different aspect of this same object that I'm seeing. But it's the same thing. We're seeing it completely differently because we're looking at two different sides of it. She said, if you physically come around and stand on the same side as me, now we're looking at it in the same way. We're seeing it the same way. And she said it's just a simple exercise. But it seems like every time you talk to somebody, when you strive for understanding, in your mind you simply have to somehow try to get on that same side so you can be, you're actually describing the same thing. And so I think that's, to me, that's what you're saying, is at the core there is a commonality that we have to seek. And if it's a difference of language, if it's a difference of interpretation, it doesn't matter. If we seek that, what's causing that difference, we'll find it. And the elation that, hey, we don't really have a difference. You know, we're really on the same page. We just didn't know it. So,
Paula, thank you for describing really what the goal is here, is to try to point out what we have in common, which we already know about, but also try to find new commonalities that are heretofore unknown, that's why we call it building bridges, because you're right. You're sitting across the table, like in your analogy of a husband and wife sitting across the table. But when you build a bridge, what are you doing? You're coming together, just like you said. You're coming to the common ground, sitting next to each other, looking at the same thing differently.
Right. And that's okay to see it differently. It's just the understanding that you're seeing the same thing. You're just describing it differently. That's okay.
Okay,
you know?
Let's go to I want to go
the
to the third
point
though about the Trinity.
Sure.
Because and by the way, I want our listeners, I want you to know, Mark, and you know, just so you know, as the Erasmus readers, we are Trinitarian. We have a different, little bit of a different concept of the Trinity, but we do believe that God is one in three persons. So, what's the misperception problem here?
Well, I think then we can have the Muslim, Christian, Erasmus, all three together. In this case, okay. It's, first of all, the word Trinity, and I'm not denouncing it, but it's not in any of the translation, including the Greek, Latin, or Aramaic. The word is a word given by the Western world for concept. What is the concept is given to? Well, there's a God, according to the scriptures, and there's a spirit, and there's a Messiah named Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what is generally perceived as what we call in the Western world the Trinity. The Quran denounces the Trinity directly. But here, are you ready for something interesting? The Trinity in the Quran is God, is Jesus, and Mary. It doesn't mention the spirit. Because of the worship of Mary in the Arabian Peninsula in the 6th and 7th centuries is so strong, even the Trinity was misunderstood back then to be God, Jesus, and Mary, not the Spirit. Nonetheless, let's get to the crux of it. The Torah, the Quran, and the Gospels, in the original Semitic languages, all three have the same name for God. It's rooted in Illah, I-L-A, Illah. That means the deity. So every book we're referring to, the Torah, the Quran, has God, okay? And everyone says, yes, we know that, so what? All right, let's go to the next level. The Torah, the Quran, and the Gospels also have Holy Spirit in all three of them. And they all acknowledge, yeah, the Muslims say yes, the Holy Spirit's in our holy book too. I said, great. And in fact, the term for the Holy Spirit is exactly the same. In the Hebrew Torah, it's Ruach HaKadosh. Here's that word again, Paul, Ruach. Ruach HaKadosh. In the Arabic, it's Ruach HaKudus, very similar. And in the Aramaic, it's Ruach HaDishkusha. So they have Holy Spirit in all three. Lastly, and finally, in the Torah, there's a coming Messiah, Messiah, which it doesn't say Jesus, but it talks about the Messiah. In the Quran, it talks about Isa, Al-Messiah, Jesus the Messiah. And lastly, the Gospels have Ishu Al-Mashita, Jesus the Messiah. So all three Semitic books, all three Semitic languages have identical, precise, the same name linguistically of all three entities. So in conclusion, I go to my theological Christian leaders and say, Mr. Theologian, how do these three entities, whatever they are, interrelate together? And they say, you know, it's a mystery. I said, all right, great. But you believe they're all these deified attributes of God, meaning God, the Holy Spirit, and Jesus, Messiah. They would say yes. So I go to the Muslim scholars. I say, how does God interrelate with the Holy Spirit and interrelate with Jesus, the Messiah, who's the Word of God? They say, we really don't know. It's a mystery. And I say, well, thank God. We've resolved this Trinity problem very simply. I'm saying, first, Trinity is not a word we need to use because it offends the Muslims, even though we like it. But the word itself is not biblical. But the three entities are there in all holy books. And how they relate together remains, at least with the two main faiths, a big mystery.
Okay, but you know what? And I don't want to get into nitpicking over doctrines either. But you know what? The fact is, though, that as Christians, and I would count myself as a Christian, even though I'm a follower of the Erasmus book. As Christians, we, you know, I believe Christians believe that the Trinity isn't just three manifestations of God or three aspects of God. We believe that it's God in three persons. In fact, the Erasmus book puts it this way: they say if God is a Father, then there was never a time when God wasn't a father. So God always had a son. God was never solitary. And the book talks about how God was always in relation, you know, in relationship with the two other persons of the Trinity. So, I mean, how do we get around the whole three? I mean, are we talking about three persons, or because some Christians will say there's a difference between three persons and three manifestations, and I think they do have a point. So I mean, I guess the question I'm asking is, are we asking each faith to water down their doctrines, or what?
No, it's a very good question. What we're saying is that look at all three holy books in question have the exact same the terminologies for all three of these entities. How you define them in Islam is somewhat of a mystery. Christians say it's less of a mystery. We think they're three persons. Urantia evidently says, as you would say, that they're also three persons.
Yes.
The fact of personhood, the fact of attributes in the Quran is 99 names of Allah in the Quran. I say there are 99 gods. I say, heaven forbid, there's only one God. Well, Jesus said repeatedly there's only one God. Paul said repeatedly there's only one God. But that doesn't mean there can be more than one manifestation of God and reflected in the Holy Spirit and perhaps in the Messiah Jesus. Now you want to. So once we get that far, I think we're to a point where we're no longer going to at least kill each other over whether it's the three are persons or how they precisely interrelate. I'd be curious to know from you now, how does the Urantia book say that the Holy Spirit, God, and Jesus interrelate? Does it give a explanation that we could understand better?
Well, Paula, maybe you can address that, because your answer gives us an enhanced cosmology, too. That's part of the reason why it's different. But maybe you can sort of tell Mark a little bit about the Urantia book's view of the Trinity.
Well, the Urantia book spends a great deal of time on the Trinity, obviously. I mean, a huge amount of time on the Trinity. And, the first thing that it says, the very first line in the book, in the minds of the mortals of Urantia, that being the name of your world, there exists great confusion respecting the meaning of such terms as God, divinity, and deity. Human beings are still more confused and uncertain about the relationships of the divine personalities designated by these numerous appellations. Because of this conceptual poverty associated with so much ideational confusion, I have been directed to formulate this introductory statement in explanation of the meanings which should be attached to certain word symbols and so on. And so clearly the Trinity is one of the concepts that is most confusing to people. It just is. And the Urantia book tells us, look, we know that these terms confuse you. We know that it's almost impossible for the finite mind to understand transactions that happened in eternity. But they say the first thing you should understand is that God is the first great source and center of all things. And then from the first great source and center, and then they try to explain the original transaction that God had to create his deity associates. Because in his infinite oneness, there was no relationship. Chris Halverson is the best person I can think of to describe these transactions because he just does it so beautifully. But the bottom line is, he created his first deity associate, which was the infinite Son. The Urantia book says clearly the infinite Son is not Jesus. Jesus is one of many powerful sons of God, but he's not the only one, and he's not the second person of the Trinity. And then it says in cooperation together, the first great source and center and the second great source and center created the third great source and center. And this constitutes the Trinity. And really, when you look at it, it's like my friend Steve McIntosh describes it as the three stools that hold up a plane. You can't hold up reality with one or with two. You have to have
three. I have to interject just for a second, Paul, and I don't want to get into a whole argument about this. I don't think, from my reading of the Urantia book, though, I don't get the sense that the Trinity was ever created. The book talks about how there was...
that's what it's... says you know those are concepts that you can't really describe to a finite mind.
No, it doesn't use the word create. It doesn't actually. It says God never had a first thought or a. It talks about this hypothetical thing called the I am, which the I am is sort of a hypothetical construct that they use to talk about how. They actually say though that the Trinity has always existed. They say that. That's the only point I'm making, is the Trinity has always existed. There are places in the book that mention that a couple of times.
Well, Andre, we only have a couple minutes left, but this just makes my point exactly, that no matter who we are, whether we're followers of Urantia, Christianity, Islam, or combinations of all of them, this whole notion is very complex. It maybe
it
is beyond the finite mind of our limited brain power to grasp this infinite notion, but all I want to argue is in terms of Islam and Christianity anyway, getting down to
that point
in the book, A Deadly Misunderstanding, that we can come to the same agreement that, yes, it's a tremendous mystery. Yes, each individual, like you have a slightly different view, perhaps Paula does, and maybe that I do, and my wife may, but the point is we agree there's a God, there's a Jesus, who a begotten Jesus, and there's the Holy Spirit, and they have deified nature to them, and how they interrelate is precisely to understand that. To grasp that is definitely a mystery. And if you like to talk about the I Am, there's a huge linguistic construct around that if you're interested in pursuing that now or later.
Okay, let me ask you this, though. As you mentioned, speaking of language, you talk about Aramaic. I want to talk about this for a second because aren't the earliest manuscripts of the New Testament, are the earliest manuscripts of the New Testament in Greek, or are the earliest manuscripts of the New Testament in Aramaic?
That's a very good question. The earliest that we have are Greek. However, the Peshitta text, which is in London, is from the 4th or 5th century. The Eastern mentality was like we do with the American flag. If it becomes tattered, we make sure to replicate it carefully and ceremoniously burn it with honor and distinction. So the Jews would take the Torah, and the followers of Jesus would take the gospel when they become tattered, fastidiously copy them, and then burn them. So unfortunately, unless they hid them like they did in the caves of Qumran and other places, we would never find originals because they would have been burned. Where the Greek Western mind said, let's keep everything, which is a good idea. You know, we keep every little manuscript, every little piece for antiquity's sake. So I believe personally that the Aramaic was the verbalized gospel of Jesus. And the Muslims say the only Holy Quran's in Arabic because the angel Gabriel, according to them, gave the Quran or the recitation to Prophet Muhammad in Arabic. So all other translations would be considered noble but not holy. And therefore, the Muslims argue, how can the Bible be in Greek if Jesus spoke the original gospel in Aramaic? It would have to be the Holy Bible or gospel should be in Aramaic. We've told them, no problem, we found it. And that's why there's such enthusiasm on both sides.
That makes sense.
Wow. So what about... Go ahead. I'm sorry, Paul.
Well, I just wanted to finish my point, and that is that in reality, if we think holistically, there's thought, word, deed, truth, beauty, goodness,
that's
origin,
true,
history, destiny, mother, father, child. That is, the three is the one, in a sense. That's the whole point. The three is unified in the one. But the Urantia book unequivocally says that God is the one God, the first source and center of all things and beings, and that monotheism is a highly evolved concept of God, one God.
Right.
You know, and so we get hung up on the Trinity. It's just too bad.
I want to ask you too, Mark, about the word jihad. How has that word been mistranslated or misunderstood?
Yeah, well, this is really critical, especially in contemporary culture. A jihad is actually an Aramaic understanding used in Daniel 7 to mean strive. I strive toward something. It's more of an internal striving. And it means in the Arabic to struggle. It does not mean holy war. That is a total twisted understanding. I studied every single use of struggle, the word jihad, in the Quran. And there are like, I know, at least 32 that I have found anyway. And almost none of them have anything to do with aggressivity or killing or martyrdom or strapping bombs around people and blowing themselves up in what they call the holy jihad. I would argue that is a distorted lie that the militants are using. And unfortunately, the shouts of the peaceful Muslims saying, wait a minute, jihad means an internal struggle to keep yourself cleansed from the evil effects of the world upon you. That has been twisted and distorted. They are silenced by this what I call the damnation of taking this word into a horrible context of killing.
They've politicized it, in other words, do you think, to reach a political...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's totally politicized. And actually, the word jihad in Aramaic means I'm tired or I'm exhausted. It means in modern Aramaic, it means in many Syriac dialects, it means like I'm tired, you know, we've struggled, we've striven to do something, but it never has anything to do with killing people or holy war. It's a really an unfortunate twist.
So Mark, do you think that one thing we could do, and this is what occurs to me as I read your book and as I've heard you speak and even last week, that one thing we can do maybe is bolster our relationship between moderate Muslims and create a bridge of understanding. I don't think we're going to be able to create this with these radicals, but perhaps we can create true alliances with sincere Muslims who have a true understanding or a better understanding and are more willing to, become allied with, I mean, would you see that as a way to because I worry that, those who politicize religious teachings and whip up people into a frenzy, you're not going to get them to come on board, you know, but maybe if you could create strong enough allies with those who are reasonable and
excellent, Paul. Our time is over. May I just conclude with two thoughts relating directly to what you just said? First of all, there is a tipping point. Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book called Tipping Point,
yes.
And I believe that Islam's at a tipping point. They're reassessing their teachings, the militant teachings. They're reassessing themselves, especially post-9/11, the bloodshed over 10 years in Algeria of 100,000 deaths, and now in Iraq, Muslims killing Muslims, and now even now in Palestine. So Muslims are reassessing what is their faith all about. And while they're in this process of what Christians might call reformation, the Western world has a choice. We have to choose whether or not we push the Quranic interpretation that it says to kill the Jews and the Muslims, I mean the Jews and the Christians and infidels, or that we challenge that interpretation, support the vast majority of peace and Muslims to suggest the Quran does not promote death and killing, but rather promotes peace. And any verses like that should have been in context 1,400 years ago in a certain situation that's no longer relevant today, like the found verses in the Bible. And secondly, and very importantly, this whole idea of transformation of the mind and militants. Ed Meese, the former Attorney General and Heritage Foundation, they're very conservative, but they are investigating in Iraq and Saudi Arabia and even in Yemen, where the Muslims are taking the Quran, going to the militants who are in prison, the terrorists already tried and convicted, and they're being converted, so to speak, or re-indoctrinated, when they can prove by the Quran that actually Quran is not violent, that they were taught was a deception and a twist of the truth, and there are hundreds and hundreds of militants who are literally turning, as we say, to the more peaceful view of their faith.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, that's really encouraging.
Yeah, it is. And I've talked to Wahhabis myself, I've talked to radicals, and once you get over, I tell you, these three big issues, you know, the Son of God, the Trinity, and the deity of Jesus, and you can tell them that you feel, you know, the spiritual commonalities we can have together, that we don't hate the Quran, we don't hate their prophet, we don't hate their faith or their culture. Once you can bridge these critical issues, it's amazing how I believe in the Spirit of God. I believe in the power of God to change. He changed my heart and continues to do so. Why couldn't he change a militant's heart? Is it beyond that? No one's beyond the reach of God.
Well, thank you for that. You're so right. You're so right. No one is beyond that reach, and if they love God, then God will reach them. He can reach them.
Wow. Wow. Well, Mark, it's been really great having you on the show. I really appreciate it. I wish we could get some callers here, but I don't know. I don't really know exactly. I guess what I was going to say to you in closing here is, or ask you in closing. Well, first of all, again, can you tell people how to get your book?
Yes, you can go to adeadlymisunderstanding.com. It'll tell you much about the book and where to buy it. You can go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or your bookstore.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for being on with us at the Cosmic Citizen. Thank you. And by the way, we will definitely send you a copy of the Urantia book.
All right. Well, God bless you both, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, Paula, it's
Andre.
just It's just amazing. It's amazing to have somebody who, and one of the things, you know, that I forgot to ask Mark, but it's something that I'm sure you can even address because you've been around the world. Don't you think sometimes as Americans, it'd be good for most of us to get out of our own country and to really see, I mean, I'm starting to have much more of a desire to do that. I've been to England and Canada, but I actually would like to go to the third world. I just think that we need a broadening of our perspective. And, you know, if we're going to become cosmic citizens, we've got to start by becoming world citizens.
Well, of course. Absolutely. And in my experience, Andre, I think I've said it before, you know, every time, it's not about two. I think one mistake Americans make is they go to other parts of the world and expect that part of the world to be just like America.
Right.
Well, it's not. And I think there's a word for that in certain quarters of the world where they call that the ugly American attitude. And, you know, where we go there and expect that we should get everything that we're used to having here. And it just doesn't happen. So, but go there with a wonderful attitude of learning. I want to learn who you are, what you do, what you think, just like Mark did, you know, in his book. I was so touched by that segment where he said, you know, I said, I want to talk to these people. And we went and over lunch or over dinner, we talked, and I asked them a series of questions. What do you believe about this? How do you feel about what can I do as an American to bolster my status in the world and improve your opinion of me? I thought that was such an important question to ask. A person from another world. What do you think of me as an American? What do you believe about America? When I went to India last year, I was so touched by these Indians who wanted to know, how are you going to vote? You know?
Wow.
And I realized in this election, this was not our election. We were the lucky ones. We got to vote for this president. We had that honor and that privilege. But the rest of the world sees how important who we elect is to the safety and security of the world. They see it. They were watching with great detail. These Indians had very pointed questions for me about who I was going to vote for and why. They wanted to know. And, you know, I was touched by that because they understand maybe better than we do that we are a global community. We can no longer say, well, that doesn't involve me. What happens to them over there? None of my business. We can't do that. We don't have that luxury anymore. I don't.
Well, we have in there, you know, India, is, from what I understand, is becoming more and more of an ally with the United States. So, I mean, I you know, that makes sense. I guess I want to be able to. I'm feeling myself go through a bit of a paradigm crash myself, and it's too long to go into here. But my political worldview is changing a lot as well, and I think that, I guess I want my paradigm to be expanded. So I'm kind of, I just have this feeling. I'm thinking more and more about how, about a desire to go to another country and to just interact with people there and to you know, see things from, you know, from their perspective and to.
Well, you know, Andre, that's one of the things the book says will bring about world peace is the advent of travel, being able to travel. Because how can we get to know each other? It's just what Mark said. You know, he had these solidified ideas about Islam. And then when he got to know Muslims and talked to them and really, and obviously he's a man of integrity. He went in depth. I mean, you know, this friend of his posed this question to him and he searched his own soul for the answer. He didn't take a passive attitude about it. And what you're talking about, I want to go travel the world. I want to get to know people. That's not a passive thing. That's a proactive thing to do.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I think we have a caller, Andre, and caller, I'm sorry if I haven't answered this call. It's showing up as all zeros, but let's see if we have a caller. Hold on. Hello, you're on Blog Talk.
Hello, it's me, Jor, California.
Oh, Jor, I'm sorry.
Hey,
you know,
that's all right.
You were showing up as all zeros, and so I didn't know for sure if it was a caller or not.
Right, I think it's because I have, some blocking thing on my phone or something.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, I just want to tell you guys how much I enjoyed the show, and I really liked Mark's perspective and his ability to find unity in the diverse religions there and his effort at doing that. And I want to encourage Andre to have faith, to be spiritually strong, because sometimes it sounds like, you know, he might get a little bit down or something. But I think there's a lot of truth.
That's funny you should say that. I've been up and down the last few days.
So anyway, but have strength, spiritual strength. These are tough times, but I think that we're getting who we need to lead us. And I think that, you know, with the ideas like Mark, I'm seeing more and more ideas that have been put forth in the Urantia book, you know, 40 or 50 years ago, coming to the forefront. I think it's blossoming, and the time's coming when these ideas are going to become more and more prominent in a diverse amount of ways. So thank you, guys. And thank you.
Well, you know what I'm reminded of, and you're welcome, and thank you. Thank you for being such a great listener, Joan. What I'm reminded of is something that got said by Carlton Pearson. You know, I don't know if you guys picked up on this, but Carlton made a prophecy right here on our show. And,
what did he say?
He said,
I was listening to that show, but I might have missed the prophecy. What was that?
Well, the prophecy was, he said in 2009, many paradigms are going to crash and many ideas about long-cherished beliefs are going to change. Do you remember that, Andre? I'm paraphrasing. I don't remember exactly.
Vaguely. I mean, I remember him making prophecies, but that wasn't the one that I remembered.
Yeah.
What's the one you remembered, Andre?
In 2009, he said that would happen. What did you think, Andre?
The one I was thinking of when he was talking about how that we were he was telling us we were going to get speaking opportunities and all this other stuff, and he told us that that the Urantia ideology, as he put it, is going to get more wide public acceptance and that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, that's maybe you said both too. You know, I'll have to go back and re-listen to the show now. But I just remember Ann making the comment on the board, "Wow, he's saying prophecy," and I thought, because it was funny because I thought the same exact thing at the moment she said that on the board. So
it makes sense. And the thing you were saying, Paula, about the world recognition of this president, I went to a place called on the internet called If the World Could Vote. And there was responses from 206 different countries, and 89% of them were in favor of the president-elect. And I don't think I've ever seen a leader of our country be more recognized in the world than this one is right now. If there was a world election right now, I think he might win, you know, for all the countries of the world. I mean, there's so much support worldwide for him and interest.
Well, you know, I think there's a political barrier here, and you hate to mix politics, and you know we're always so afraid to talk about that because it's like religion. Here we are talking about religion, and politics is like that. We hold these things so dear to our heart, and you know, I grew up hearing people say, well, the three things you never want to talk about is sex, politics, and religion, and
those are the most interesting things in human life.
I know. I was just going to say, those are things everybody wants to talk about.
But they do cause
fights, let's face it. But I have to agree with you, Joe. I heard this thing this morning, the same exact thing. A newscaster was saying he was over in another country when this election happened, and he said, I have never seen such an outpouring of joy from around the world for a president-elect in America. He said, I've never seen this happen before. It just blew me away.
Yes.
And I think there's something transcendental about that. You know, the Urantia book tells us that only 1% of the population are really true leaders. And
yes,
for a long time down here on this planet, the blind have been leading the blind.
Right.
And I got to tell you, I grew up without a whole lot of hope. When John F. Kennedy was assassinated, I was 8 years old. And then Robert, and the last insult was Martin Luther King, because
right,
as an idealistic 13-year-old, I would listen to this man who was speaking great truths. They resonated in my heart.
I think,
and
the,
I said,
feeling,
I
think the feeling
ahead,
that you have about that loss is a common feeling in the country. And I think the jubilant reaction to this last election and even the tears are actually a reflection you know, that there's a change, a possibility of change now that was lost in those three assassinations, and now we have the chance back. And it's an opportunity. We'll see what happens. You know, we hopefully we'll do the best we can with it. And,
well, and we have to be willing to let go of our ideologies for a while and say, let's give this a try.
There's another book, Andre, called Super Capitalism by Robert Reich that just came out, and it's very similar to the capitalism described on Government on a Neighboring Planet in Urantia, where there's a balance to it, and there's morals, there's moral issues that are dealt with by the capitalism, and in response to the Reverend's comment and prediction of changes taking place in 2009, that this is just another piece of evidence of these changes coming, and Mark's book, you know, on terms of how he can see the unity in the Torah and the Quran and the Bible and between these peoples, very interesting. One question I had for Mark I didn't get to ask, I wonder how Muslims saw Melchizedek, because they go back to the Abrahamic religion that started with Melchizedek, and I wonder, he's seen by some as divine and argued that he's not, that he's a son of Shem, and stuff like that. I was wondering how the Muslims saw him. Do any of you know Melchizedek?
You know, I think I saw your question on the board, and I'm sorry I didn't get it in.
Oh,
because
all right.
I think that's a great question. And I don't know if they even recognize Melchizedek.
Okay, yeah, because the three religions, you know, are based on the Abrahamic tradition, which started with Melchizedek. And he was he was a divine entity that appeared on earth, and he taught. He celebrated with bread and wine, and he taught about the Trinity and the true religion of God. When I say true, I mean the evolving religion, the evolving reality.
You know, I don't know if
Islam
could trace its roots to Melchizedek because of when it occurred. And when I was in India in January, I made some very good Muslim friends there, and they gave me the Quran, and I brought it home, and I was reading it on the plane. And you know, I think most people don't realize that the prophet Muhammad was called in the story that it's telling. He was called out by Gabriel.
Yes.
Isn't that interesting?
And transported to Jerusalem, and everything was revealed to him in that night.
Yeah. And that's something I never knew, that Gabriel actually was supposedly the being that called him out and gave him his revelation. And just the whole situation of the world that was going on. And in fact, Islam, or the original Muslim faith, was very much persecuted and hated.
Yes.
And
yes,
they
was.
Really had to fight just to survive. So I think that's where some of the militant part comes in.
That's based on our human trend to have war, but I think spiritually we're evolving and getting ready to shed that. The sooner the better.
You know, I was a lot of times I have great insights when I'm just riding in my car. Don't ask me why. I have noticed that when my hands are busy doing something, and you know, you go into a super conscious place, and this is what I've noticed. And some of my greatest insights come when I'm in this state where I'm engaged. My other senses are engaged, and so I go into this super conscious place. And what I saw was the chrysalis, or the cocoon. You know, the Urantia book uses that analogy that the religion of Jesus lies sleeping in the cocoon of Christianity. And I see that in a broader perspective, that all of humanity are, in a sense, in this cocoon. And we've had the veil pulled over our eyes by hundreds and thousands of years of rebellion, and we're really steeped in rebellion. It's so much a part of who we are, we can't see it. And what I saw was that the shell that separates us from the light of God is very thin now. Very, very thin.
Good. That's an interesting way to put it. It's like it's thinning out. It's
paper
slowly
thin.
Being removed.
Right,
and
it's just going
to
take
more.
Right, and what I got was, Joer, is just one epiphany, one great epiphany in the world, and it's just going to shatter. and we're going to be standing in the light of you know, the love of God.
Sounds excellent.
And nothing will make it will ever make us turn back.
That's true.
That it's going to be a world epiphany, that it's just like we're just so close. That's what I got. We're just so close. That was
really amazing. I'm waiting for that epiphany with you. And, and I hope I'm part of bringing it to us. I think we can all stand up and do our best to bring that, you know, that epiphany home.
Yeah, hold up
home
the light.
To our world. Yeah,
you know?
Hold it up and let
it
shine.
Up. Yeah, exactly.
So keep smiling, Andre. I'll let you guys go and get back to the show, and I really appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you
Thanks
very much.
Thanks for calling.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Have a great week.
And just to reiterate, our phone number again is 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158 in case anybody wants to call in. So, do we have a song we can play? Do we have a song we can play, Paula?
A song? But we just got another caller.
Oh, good, good. Okay, good.
Okay, well, let's answer the phone. Hold on. 514, you're on Blog Talk.
Hi, Paula. Hi, Andre.
Hi, Diane.
Yes.
First of all, I want to say thank you so much, Andre and Paula, for asking Mark those questions, because we cannot resolve a problem until we know the cause. And for Mark to have explained in detail what were the three contentions within the Islamic movement, it was so fantastic. And I just wanted to share with you and the audience something that really struck me when I discovered that. I've been studying different religions, and you know, Paula, how much I love movies and videos to educate myself on all aspects of life, from politics to religions and in between. And when I started to study about Islam, to better know the people, to get to know them better so I could love them better, understand them better, I rented a lot of videos to educate myself. And one day I fell into this most amazing, interesting video of a guy who wanted to know more why this thing was going on, this jihad movement and all this warring from the Islamic movement and all that. And he made a whole video on the research and the discoveries that he had made. And then all of a sudden, he said that when they wanted to know why, what was at the cause, at the root of this increase of violence so suddenly happening in the Islamic movement, he went back to the 1976, at one point where Ayatollah Khomeini was talking, and he said, quote-unquote, and it really, it will stay with me because it really struck me, it said, the tree, he said, the tree that feeds Islam must nourish itself of the blood of its martyrs if it is to survive. And it just showed me a very vivid example of the power of words and what can happen when the word becomes either constructive or destructive. The consequences of that and the tangent that a direction can take, the change in direction, and the consequences of that, and that gave, he says in the video, that it started to create, with the distortion, he literally created a distortion of understanding, just like Marx says in his book, a deadly misunderstanding, and it gave rise to this valor, you know, of giving your life and killing and being martyrs, you know, in the name of Islam, because otherwise we don't want the tree of Islam to die if it's not going to have our blood to survive. And I thought, wow, what a powerful statement, you know, and he was relating it from footage. So I just wanted to share this because when the truth is known, like Jesus said, it sets us free. So if those truths keep on coming out, well, hopefully it will shed enough light to say, oh, now that we understand, we don't need this, and this is what the three of you today have helped so much to do, to bring light, this bridging between the three religions, and then your guests who just called and talked about the Melchizedek teachings, and then those three religions and all that. When we start understanding, we will stop fighting and probably start rejoicing. So the reason for my call was really to mention that specific moment when Ayatollah Khomeini gave meaning to his words, and that spread, you know, like wildfire, the idea that now it's right to kill ourselves in the name of our religion, in the name of our belief. I just wanted to share this, if it can help.
Well, I think you make such an amazing point, Diane, because from what I've heard from very knowledgeable people who have discussed the causes of fundamentalism, the root cause is fear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fear of losing, in a sense, it's a fear of losing identity and culture. We identify with certain cultures and certain values. And the thought, you know, humans, I don't know if you guys have ever experienced this. When you work for a corporation, you see it a lot. Big change will come down from the top, from management, and everybody gets disconcerted about it. They all kind of go wacko because they just don't want to change anything. And change is scary. I don't know why it is so scary for us humans. Maybe it's because we're just fundamentally insecure after all we've been through. But change scares us. And so the root cause that most experts agree have started this fundamental movement in Islam and Christianity and all of the above has been fear of losing our
exactly.
culture.
Exactly.
Ourselves.
And that's when you see how someone can use that for the good of all and the glory of God, or the opposite, for dividing to conquer. And we're just being made puppets because we do not know. And that just shows. And when we say Jesus was the Word of God, we just show when we read and study in this, most importantly, live the life and teachings of Jesus, we know the meaning of the Word of God, the words of Jesus, and the good it does. So when it falls into the mind of some mischievous person that has power in his hands and wants to use it for wrongdoing, just creating that fear, as you said, Paula, and just using an expression. And we hear that very often. We hear little children growing up as adults and saying when they have a problem, they go into therapy and they go to the root cause and they find out, oh, my God, it was just like my parent or my friend or my teacher at school had told me this, whatever the expression is, and that left such an indelible impression in me that it caused a blockage. So when I was seeing that video and heard that, the tree that feeds Islam must nourish itself of the blood of its martyrs if it is to survive, I can understand that someone taking that literally will say out of fear, we don't want to lose our belief, our religion, you know, our whole work that we've done, so let's go for it, and it just creates mishavoc, you know. So
yeah.
Thank you so much for having this, Andre. You're having incredible guests that are helping people.
Yes,
I'm going to let
are,
you go.
Andre. All right, my dear. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay, bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Andre, you're being very quiet. For
once I didn't have much to say. It's one of those times. It's one of those rare times when I just don't have a lot to say. I don't know what I'm usually not at a loss for words, but today I am. So I don't know whatever happened to Andre Controversa. He's just been neutered today.
Well, you sure asked some great questions
of our
guest, and I think you're doing a great job. And we might, you know, Diane has suggested a guest for this show. young Muslim woman, and
yeah, she mentioned her to me too.
Yeah, can you think of her name?
No, I don't remember her exact name, but I don't want to. It's going to be something I'd rather do in the future because we've kind of spent the last couple of weeks already on this topic, so I want to kind of
it is a valuable topic. I noticed that after the election there was a resurgence of this fear thing. I got several emails almost immediately about you know the Muslim threat and you know Muslims in London holding up signs the infidel must die, behead him, stuff like that. And you know, and then our guest last week who what is it, Dr. Jasser, who
mm-hmm.
pointed out that it's a real threat. You know, it's not just a imaginary.
Right.
But
right.
But I can't help but also think of the great words of Franklin Roosevelt when he took office. And he took, you know, I found that quote. I happened upon that quote about Moses, how nobody ever took to lead a more dejected and a group of human beings. And something about that in the book about Moses leading those dejected group of human beings, and this analogy of Franklin Roosevelt taking office at the worst time in economic time in American history, just about, and something he said restored people's hope. And I was really reflecting on this idea of hope. And hope versus, you know, faith versus fear, because I believe that faith and fear are the antithesis of each other. It's not hate and love necessarily. Fear is the cause of all hateful things, and faith is the cause of all good and beautiful things and loving things. If we have real faith, our faith transcends our fear. You know, and certainly we'll want to be realistic and we want to be pragmatic. But, you know, just reflecting on these realities of faith and fear, and then hearing this story about Franklin Roosevelt saying to these people, when I think he was president-elect, and one of the first things he said was, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I have thought about that saying so many times in my life.
But you know what's interesting, Paula? You know, sometimes fear, though, can be a positive thing, can be a good motivator. I mean, I remember one time years ago I was at a Urantia conference, actually, and somebody at the conference said, we're talking about what could we do in the world? What will bring peace to the world, you know, or what will get us to avoid war? And this person said, well, one motivator may be fear, you know, fear of just how bad things will be if we end up in a nuclear war or something like that. You know, so, you know, even God can even use fear sometimes.
Well, and certainly, in, you know, this world is rife with it, isn't it? I mean, because of all that we've been through, terror abounds on this planet. I know you haven't had this experience, but imagine bringing a precious child onto this world,
mm-hmm.
the fear involved in that. And if you don't have, I don't know how people survive down here without faith. I really don't. But I think that if we proceed with fear, if we let fear lead, and we do what we do, the actions we take are based on that, I think then that's what causes us to do the exact wrong thing. Because it's not rational. What is it the Urantia book says? Fear is a master intellectual fraud practiced upon the evolving mortal soul. A master intellectual fraud. And
well, it's kind of like, to me, fear, I look at fear the same way I look at guilt. You know, and actually you told me once that fear, you said on the air, I love this, you said fear was an alarm clock. You know, that it's something that we, you know, it needs to come on at times, then we need to turn it off eventually. You know, so it has a temporary usefulness, but it's not meant to be, we're not supposed to be in a perpetual state of that. And I think, and fear to me is very similar to guilt, because guilt can be a good thing, but you can also have false guilt. You can start feeling guilty about things that you never did, that were not,
right.
You know, that are not wrong, or that you can start feeling guilty for things that are not your fault. And I think the same thing can be true of fear. I mean, what does the Aransas book tell us in the Maranshamoda? The greatest disappointments to bear, the hardest disappointments to bear, are those that never come. And I find that to be one of the most profound things in the book because I find that the things I worry about most never come true anyway.
Well, Brother Dave added to my little quote there that the quote is unreasoned fear, and it's definitely what you're just saying.
Yeah, exactly.
Some
because,
fears are reasonable fears, and we have to know that. Some fears are reasonable fears, and some threats are reasonable threats, and we know that. There's a reality in the world that the world is not a safe place. It's a violent place, and that's reasonable. And you can't go walking down blind alleys with $100 bills hanging out of your pockets,
mm-hmm.
you know, because that's a reasonable fear. You lock your doors at night. You're practicing. And, I mean, as a woman, I know I'm more vulnerable than, you know, we women know we're vulnerable. We check the back seat when we get in the car, you know. And so you live with fear. There's a certain level of fear that you live with always. And on this planet especially, but I think we really have to look at our unreasoned fear that causes us to go out and do irrational things that make, you know, that just add fuel to the fire. They make things worse than they were before.
And by the way, I also want to say, and I should have asked Mark this, there are a couple of things I wish I had asked Mark. One was, you know, people are going to accuse him of being naive. You know, I know that's what they're going to say. This is so naive. You think you can be friends with all these people? And you know, because he had dinner with, you know, he was talking with dictators and people who were, you know, that a lot of people would be scared to be within a dark alley. You know, and to me that shows that he had the kind of faith that Jesus has. You know, and to me that's as you said, he's an incredibly courageous person. But the other thing I was going to say is apparently there was a meeting recently with the Vatican and Muslims. I remember reading about it a few days ago, and it's just very interesting because, you know, it's interesting they could have such a meeting because a few years ago the Pope said something that really inflamed the Muslims. He said something about how he quoted some emperor from the Middle Ages who said the Muslim faith contained only things that were evil and inhuman, and I can't remember the specifics of the quote, but it was really to me pretty amazing that, you know, they could come together, the Vatican and the Muslims could come together after the Pope made this inflammatory statement a few years ago. I actually think the Pope was misunderstood. That's a whole other discussion. But anyway, the point is it was a newsworthy, the issue was very newsworthy given what Mark is saying in his book, and I wish I had asked Mark about that. But
you know, and we have a caller, but before I take the call, hold on, caller, I'm going to get to you. I just want to share a story, and this story I think is just so beautiful. Our good friend Crystalline Beek Larson. Mm-hmm. I love this story because it shows how you can, just like Jesus, you can call out the best, and how unreasoned fears sometimes can call out the worst in another person. When she was very young, she was selling insurance. And she's such a brave person. She was raised in Africa. Her parents were medical missionaries, and so she wasn't afraid of anybody. And she used to go into poor black communities to sell insurance, and she was their top insurance salesperson. And she said, she said they need insurance too. So she would go into these neighborhoods She had gone into this community, I want to say it was a bar, but you know there were all kinds of people in there. And she parked her car and walked in there, and she was talking to all kinds of people. And she's so friendly and so engaging, and she was having the best time. Well, she lost track of time, and by the time she walked outside, and she had sold a lot of policies to people, and by the time she walked outside, it was dark. And now she had to walk back to her car through several dark alleys. And so she was scared, and rightfully so. So she's walking through this alley, and she said, here she is all by herself, and she's gorgeous, and she was young and beautiful and vulnerable. And she saw this bike gang, motorcycle gang. And she said they looked about as rough and tumble as anybody you can imagine. and here she was all by herself, and it was predominantly a minority group of bikers, and they were looking at her in a way that made her really, really nervous. And so she immediately prayed to God, and she said, "Heavenly Father, please give me something to say that will diffuse this situation." And without another thought, she walked right up to this group of bikers, and she said, "Oh, my gosh, I am so glad to see you. You can't imagine how glad I am to see you." She said, "You know, I was over there and I was talking to some folks and I lost track of time and I walked out and it's dark." And she said, "Now I have to walk back to my car all by myself and I just feel so vulnerable and afraid. Will you guys walk with me?"
Wow.
And every single one of these guys said, "Of course we will."
Wow.
"Sure." And she said, before she knew it, they were all walking back to her car, laughing and talking. She drew out the best in them. See, she called out the best. She didn't assume the worst. She called out the best. And because she called it out, they rose to the occasion. And it all started with her saying, "You can't imagine how glad I am to see you."
Wow.
Isn't that a great story?
Yeah.
I love
yeah.
that. Because that's God in the moment.
Absolutely.
You know? Okay, so here's our caller. I think, let's see what we got here. 816, you're on Blog Talk.
Yes, it's me. Hi, it's Lee from Kansas City.
Hey, Lee.
Hi, Lee.
Hey, hi. Really enjoyed the show this week and last week. Boy, just really so fun and interesting to have the combination of a scholar and then your Rancho Book scholar. So so thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, oh, it's I love this show. I mean, I try to catch it every week. Usually I try to catch it live, but if not, you know, I can listen to it later, and I really like that. I wanted to say a couple things, like you know, probably 100 things come to your mind when you're listening. But one thing I want to say about Mark was his form of outreach to me is very powerful, because I noticed he reiterated that he is not out to win anyone to religion at all. He simply wants to explain the difference to anyone who's interested. And it's such a neutral approach that doesn't cause defensiveness. How could anybody be defensive about hearing that? And so I thought that was it kind of reminded me of the website You Be the News, which
uh-huh.
is also neutral, because it simply says here's information for people who want to, you know, read it. And I think that's a really good form of outreach. Well, maybe it is for me, because I really don't like, my skin crawls at the thought of trying to persuade anybody of anything.
Yes, I understand that 100%.
Yeah. Well, what
I don't like
say?
I don't like
I mean,
to be viewed as a salesman either.
Yeah. Or I can sell lots of things with enthusiasm, but I was mostly talking about my faith. And so, yeah, just I don't like it. But I really, really do like just saying facts like he was doing. He was drawing parallels very extensively. But, I mean, anybody who likes facts, you can weave those into any conversation and just make a parallel right while you're talking and sort of wake people up. And so I thought I'd just toss that out. As, you know, Jesus said along the way to share the gospel. And even just saying something that makes people think a little bit because you've introduced a fact, that's a form of outreach along the way.
Yeah, and it really goes to show, I mean, I think our guests, kudos to you, Andre, for picking some wonderful guests. I think that they have been knowledgeable and educational. I mean, I just find, gosh, I'd like to spend a whole day with any one of these guys. Just sit down with them and talk and find out what they think about many things. And you know, Mark, it's just amazing. He's done his homework, and I think that when you're engaging with people, you know, like for interfaith, Lee, because I know this is dear to your heart, it really helps to have a conceptual understanding of where they're coming from.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
You know, Lee, what you're saying to me reminds me of talk about this form of outreach. It reminds me of something that I've talked about on the air a couple times before, and it's something that, again, I should have mentioned to Mark. A couple of the things I forgot to mention to Mark. it reminds me of, you know, the passage in the book of Acts in chapter 17 where, you know, Paul is talking to the Athenians on Mars Hill. You know, they're all discussing philosophy over there at the ancient equivalent of Starbucks, you know, and he's saying, hey, I see by your idols over there that you're very religious. And he says, you know, I noticed that one of your idols there is to an unknown God. I'm going to show you that unknown God is. It's Jesus. And he actually quoted, he quotes pagan philosophers to make his point. A lot of Christians don't know this, but you know,
wow.
Paul actually quotes a poem to the God, a hymn to the god Zeus, when he says, "In him we live and move and have our being." You know, that's actually, as I said, it's written by a pagan poet to the god Zeus. A lot of Christians don't know that, but you know, the point I'm making is this: he does not attack their religion. He doesn't say, "Oh, you guys are a bunch of heathens. You're all idol worshippers." He says, "No." He says, "I can tell by your idols that you're very religious." You know, so you know, and I'm going to tell you who this idol, you know, who this unknown god is, and he just points them, and I feel that that's kind of what Mark is doing, the same kind of outreach.
Yeah, it is. It is. He speaks their language, you know, the language of others, other religionists, in a way that I would love to.
I thought he made a very good point when he said, look, it's irrelevant whether or not the Trinity really exists or whether or not, Mary was a virgin. It doesn't matter. If we could find anything that keeps people from killing each other,
yeah.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, because you know what? Even if they still differ, at least they can discuss it in a civil way.
Yeah.
Instead of, I mean, look at us, your anthropocrates. It's like you and Paul, like you and I, Paul, we could parse this book for hours, but we're not shooting each other, you know?
Yeah. Thank God, Andre, we'd be dead many times over if we were.
I can't imagine your ranch of terrorists. I just can't.
I think it's great though, because you two are good counterpoints to one another, and it would just be boring if there were just like two, you know, clones, you know, the host and the host clone. So, see what I'm saying? It's really good that you have different points of view and you come from different perspectives. That keeps the show really lively.
Well, you know, you can always count on men and women for that, too, can't you, Lee?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
I had a quick comment just to make to Andre. I hope you don't mind if I make it on the air, Andre. It was very small when you were talking to Mark, and most of the time, like almost all the time, you said, the book says. But just once I heard you say, we believe, and I thought, no, we don't believe anything because we're not a religion. It was when you were talking about your Rancho Book readers, not when you were talking about Christians.
But we are in a sense. I mean, we are a religious community in a sense. So we do, I mean,
well,
I
would just like you to be careful for my sake because I don't want anybody to represent what I believe.
I see what you're saying. Okay. I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay. Then maybe what you're saying, I guess what you're saying is, instead of saying we believe, I could say, because I was trying to point out that the Rancho book supported the doctrine of the Trinity. That was the only thing I was trying to point out. So would you prefer that I say that you know, the Rancho book says?
Yes.
Okay.
And I see what you're saying because we all have different interpretations. We're not one collective group. You know, we're not one collective herd who thinks the same way. That's true. Although I don't think what I was saying was particularly controversial because, you know, I don't really know of any Rancho readers who don't believe in the Trinity.
Yeah, that's not really my point, though. My point is just because you have a show and you have coverage and it's recorded, that it's, you know, the freedom of the book is important to respect in our language.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, and the freedom of interpretation, and really that is such a central concept to the Urantia book, the religion of the spirit and the religion of personal religious experience, and we have the right to interpret it the way we do, and to get out of it what we get out of it. And there is no official interpretation. And I tell people that all the time, Lee, because I think there's a hysteria about cults, and especially in the United States. And people are afraid of them. And so I often, when I introduce a book, I tell people, look, it's a book. And you are free to interpret it as you want. There is nothing to join. There are no dues to pay. We have no clergy or sacred inner sanctum of you know, knowledgeable people who know more than anybody else. If you have this book, you have the same book that I've had for these many years. You can take it on a mountaintop and read it to yourself, or you can get involved with the Urantia Book Study Group or with some other efforts being done to spread the teachings, but you don't have to. And what you get out of it is what you get out of it, and it's all for you. You know, there's no consequences if you don't read it. You know, and I like to make this clear to people because, you know, the misunderstandings, you know, especially with religionists, they think we're out there to compete, take their religion away.
Well, Andre, I'm sorry if I said that in a way that I made you defensive. I didn't mean to. I just wanted to point it out because your show, I hope your show goes all over the planet.
Well, thank you very much. Well, no, I'll try to be careful. I guess I didn't want to keep saying the book says over and over the book. You know, so I wanted to kind of make him realize that we were a community. We're not a community of identical thinkers. That's for sure. I mean, as I said, all you have to do is go into a room full of your Urantia Book readers. I mean, I believe me, I could find plenty of things to argue with Paula about, but I won't. I could argue with her till I'm blue in the face, you know. But
well,
I mean, the thing is,
let's
you
have
know,
one show of just you and Paula arguing. How about that?
Say that again.
I've done that before.
What did you say?
Have one show of just you and me
just
arguing.
Us arguing? I don't. That would be interesting. Well, you know, I'll tell you one thing I am going to do though, and this is be very. I haven't talked to you about this, Paula, but one thing I want to do, and I think our next thing after we get done with this outside the box series, I want to get into some Urantia Book controversies. I want to get some debates on the air about what does the Urantia Book say about this. I want to get into some hot shows that will make your computer explode, and we'll get some readers on who have different points of view on what the Urantia Book says about certain controversial topics, and you know, it'll be hotter than Jerry Springer.
Oh no!
it'll be trash talk radio.
But don't break any furniture though. But but I think that sounds really good, Andre. I really do, because it's, you know, it's very fun to read the book, of course, but it's really fun to hear different points, perspectives.
And you know what, though? You know what's interesting, though? Normally people think I am a very opinionated person, and people don't call me Andre Controversa for nothing. But in this particular case, when it comes to these Urantia Book controversies, if I get two people on the air to debate something, I'm actually going to remain neutral, and it's going to be very difficult for you to know what I'm going to try to be very
good. That's good. That's what I think the whole show.
Because I want them to go at it. I want them to go at it. And I know, you know, I know some people aren't going to like it, because I'm going to let them interrupt each other a little bit and get a little feisty, because, you know, some people don't like it because they're used to listening to NPR. Everybody's very polite, you know. But
I got to share something with you guys that's probably the better part of us, and that is at our conference last summer, we had so much fun, and it was a love fest. And something shifted in the movement. I mean, it was like a lot of people came back. Nancy Grimsley was there. We were hoping Vern would be there, but he couldn't make it. But, you know, it was just a love fest, and everybody bathed in brotherhood and sisterhood. And it was just what we want Urantia conferences to be, a little slice of light in life. And our affection for each other was startling, and it was so startling that people that were there were startled by it. And so much so, they kept talking about us, and they couldn't figure us out. And on the last day, when many times they would, you could just see two or three young people drawing near to us and just standing on the periphery, just wanting to come in. And of course, inevitably, somebody would say, "Well, come on in," you know. And they're like, "Oh no, it's okay." But you know, they just felt it. They felt it. And at the end of the conference, two beautiful young men, I mean, you know, both studying, one was studying to be a doctor, the other was studying to be a lawyer, walked up to our bookstore just as we were tearing it down and with all sincerity said, "Who are you people? We've been watching you all week. Who are you?"
Wow.
And what makes you this way? We want some of this.
Wow. That's awesome.
And we showed him the book, and we said, it's his book. It just, it's real, and it admonishes us to really love one another this way. You know, this book has changed our lives. And they said, well, we got to have it. And, of course, they bought it from us. They each bought a book.
Wow.
Right there and then, without even, yes, give it, I want it.
Wow.
Now, right now, they took it.
Amazing.
And it was just like, wow. See, it's there. It's in us. And it transcends all that. Anne's writing on the board, two cleaning ladies did that with her, and she gave them a Spanish book.
Mm.
We really lit that place up with our love. Mm-hmm. And love, it's not insincere. It's real. It's real love.
Mm-hmm.
And we feel it for one another. We have been drawn together by it. We've been transformed by this book, whether we know it or not. We've been transformed by it, and it shows. And so, you know, I think I hold that in my heart. I will always hold that, because we simply can't let our differences extinguish that. That is the most important.
I live for the day that happens to me. That's going to be great, you know.
Yeah. What, that you get to go to a conference and feel that?
That somebody asked me if they can buy that book, you know.
Oh, Lee, you're awesome.
Like, here, you could have mine. You know?
Here, you could have mine. I would. I would do anything to get that book into the hands of anybody who wants it.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing greater on earth. Well, we're at the end of our show, friends.
Okay, well, thanks for taking my call. And I'll be tuning in next time.
Thanks for calling.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, sweetie.
Well, I'm not sure who we're having on next week, Paula, but I will, as you know, I always end up getting someone. So we will, some topics that I have in mind, just so listeners know, a couple of topics I have in mind. One is the intelligent design controversy versus evolution. The other thing I'd like to talk about, honestly, with somebody is, it's something you may not really, a lot of people may have thought about, but the writings and works of Carl Jung, who was a fantastic psychologist and psychoanalyst, but who was an extremely spiritual person. I don't know if you know this, Paul, but before he died, there was an interview with him by the BBC, and they said, "Do you believe in God?" And he said, "I don't believe. I know." So, you know, this is a guy who had some profound experiences. In his autobiography, his chapter on life after death, it's very much like what we, you know, here we go again. We believe, here I go. But I'm going to stand by this one, though, because, this is so uncontroversial. What we as Urantric readers believe to happen to us after death, he talks about how he had a patient who had a dream that she died and there was a class going on.
Wow.
That she had to, I mean, so many things that Jung...
Beautiful.
Jung was actually the guy who was responsible indirectly for the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12-step program, which I'm sure you're aware of is a very spiritually based, God-centered program. So that's another thing that I'm considering. So, we'll see. In the next day or two, I'll make some decisions here. And we will be back with you next week on The Cosmic Citizen. And stay tuned, stay blessed, and we will look forward to talking with you again.
Bye for now.